So, please take up your seats again, and there's a microphone that we'd like people to use for the questions, so that everyone can hear what's being said. So once people are settled, then we'll pass the microphone around. Oh, please. Any questions? Don't be shy. No doubts in the room whatsoever.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes. Yes, very good.
So my question is that there are many teachers in the world who can be a real mixture of things. They can be brilliant teachers, but they can also maybe... For example, there was that very famous Tibetan teacher, wasn't there? I can't remember his name.
Chogyam Trungpa.
Yeah, he was a brilliant teacher on one hand. On the other hand... He was an alcoholic, and there are people like that who can be brilliant and also mixed. And if we encounter those kind of teachers, should we take a very moral high ground and say that their conduct is not correct? We should reject them? Or do we take a broader view? Obviously, depending on those different, if they're very harmful, mm-hmm. obviously, they can be very harmful. They can also have something to offer. And obviously, here in this monastery, you have very good conduct, so you are supported by that and what everybody else is. And that obviously, when people don't follow moral precepts, they can also cause a lot of harm and confusion and fear. So do you have anything to say about that?
That's a good question. Sometimes if you spend too much time on the moral high ground, you need oxygen up there. So it's skillful to have a very rigorous standard of sila for oneself, but then part of that, in a way, what I was saying about judgment is that sometimes people are so filled with their own rightness, they're way up on the sort of Himalayan altitude of moral, the moral high ground. They really do need, oxygen cylinders with them, and that, there can be a, even though the standards that they have are quite admirable, they can be actually filled with quite a lot of hatred and aversion, and also feeding that sense of their own, atta, their own self view, through blaming this person, that person, this person, that person. So the kind of approach that Lumpur Cha had was he didn't spend a lot of time finding fault in public ways or denouncing the other people around him or people who were less well behaved. But he put his attention on being part of the solution rather than just complaining about the problem. So with teachers like Chogyam Trungpa, there's as many people who have been his students, like Pema Chodron, who's an extremely admirable, very wise and a noble being. And she's a great teacher, and her own standards of conduct are impeccable. And she still holds her Chogyam Trungpa in high regard, even though she acknowledges he drank himself to death before he was 50. And he was extremely promiscuous. As well, and so that the amount of time we can spend finding fault with others is infinite, And so I think that also seeing that, well, someone like Pema Chodron can see the good side of her teacher and can focus on that, then you can't say, well, Trungpa's bad and everyone who's been his student is bad, therefore everything is bad that's connected with that. It's going too far, because I've spent time, I never met Chogyam Trungpa, but I certainly spent time with Pema Chodron, and she's a very inspiring and wise person. So I feel that in some respects you take whatever is good from the things that you meet. And so there are words that Trungpa has said that are very inspiring, very, very true, very helpful. But also, if you say, therefore, everything about Trungpa is good, it's going too far. So it's like Lumpur Sumedho, he was telling me a conversation he had with another well-known spiritual teacher. I think it was Firoz Mehta, they both used to teach at the Buddhist Society Summer School. And he asked Firoz Mehta this same kind of question: what's your opinion of Chogyam Trungpa and his teaching? And Firoz Mehta, who's a very, very thoughtful and wise and admirable teacher, he said, well, it's rather like being offered a beautifully delicious meal on a plate that is not clean. So that, you know, the food is delicious, but the receptacle makes you say, not quite sure if I want to eat any of this. So that was the way that Lumpur Sumedho would talk about it afterwards. Well, I feel it gets tricky is where people start to use the sort of the ultimate reality escape clause, or that sort of ultimate truth trumps everything. Maybe trump isn't the right word to use, but a few years ago it was an okay word to use, but in terms of card games, the ultimate reality trumps everything. It kind of outplays the other cards. And so that becomes really confusing and difficult for people. So I was at a conference once with a number of Western Buddhist teachers, with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And one of the teachers there had just received Dharma transmission from his teacher, a Zen master by reputation. And he had received Dharma transmission and then had dissociated himself from his teacher. And then at this conference, he said that his teacher was a quote-unquote narcissistic psychopath. That's the polite part of the sentence. I won't repeat all of it because I'm on camera. This is being recorded, but it was more colorful than that. That was the less colorful part of the description. And he said, I have no doubt that my teacher was totally enlightened, but his behavior was appalling. And the Dalai Lama so heard that and went into a huddle with his translator. Like, what, am I understanding this correctly? And then his translator, Thubten Jinpa, who was had a doctorate from Cambridge in Western philosophy, said, yes, that's what he means. And the Dalai Lama said, I think your understanding of enlightenment and mine is quite different. And it was a very helpful conversation, because within the bounds of Buddhist philosophy as that person had inherited it, you could have someone who's totally enlightened and have appalling behavior, where the Dalai Lama is much more akin to sort of classical Buddhist expressions of things and what we find in the southern Buddhist world, which is like, no, those don't go together. That if there is a mind that is truly enlightened, then that would manifest as skillful behavior. There, in Thailand, you have a number of famous ajahns who are quite quirky or eccentric in their conduct. One of Ajahn Chah's teachers, Ajahn Tongrat, was famously unpredictable, and but also regarded as an arahant. But he, his conduct would always be within the bounds of the monastic rule. That was very strictly kept, even though he's extremely eccentric and unpredictable in various ways. So that I feel that if you are reading the words of some Dhamma book and you find it inspiring, and then you find out that the author was alcoholic, okay, well, yeah, those words are helpful within the context, but I don't think I'll be voting for this person. I don't want to sign up for or any of their retreats, or that I don't particularly want to advocate that person as a great teacher. But that phrase, that says something to me. So you can't override the fact that that is meaningful to you, or that speaks to you in a helpful way. So you can take the useful words from that. But the degree to which you draw close or say, therefore, I'm supportive of this person and what they do and how they do it, that's another thing altogether. So I hope that's useful. I think we can be very moralistic and be, speaking about that, the Mark Bab Jaidi, the monk with the difficult speech habits, that we can be very righteous and we can have good justification. We can have a list of all the evidence that proves that we're right, and not be noticing that we're torturing ourselves. We're creating a lot of suffering for ourselves with our own rightness, and it makes us less able to be an effective agent of skillful change in the world, because we're so filled with all the wrongs that everybody else is doing, that we're kind of tying ourselves up in knots. So that I feel that way of appreciating or being aware of the wrongdoings or the shortcomings of others, but not creating suffering within ourselves about it. That's that's one of the skillful aspects of compassion, that you're able to acknowledge the suffering of others or caused by others, but you're not creating suffering in yourself on account of that. So, any other questions? Yes, if you can wait for the microphone. Down there in the corner with the white jacket, white shirt.
I just want to ask, what is karma? I mean, sometimes I'm Chinese, I listen to Chinese monk talk as well. And they always talk about past life, future life, all those things. I get very confused and competing.
Well, karma just means action. That's what it means. Or in Sanskrit, karma, it just means action. When people speak about that in the sort of everyday use, they tend to mean action and its results. And often they mean action from past lives that's having its effect in this life. But in its essence, karma just means action. So you just created karma by asking this question. And the result of that karma is me responding to you. So it's karma, and then the word for the result is vipaka. So it's not anything very mysterious. It's just an action based on a person's intention. That's all. I don't know if that's helpful.
We listen to monk talk on the YouTube, and then they have those monk talk about past life, someone being someone's daughter, then become a husband or become a father or that sort of thing. Very confused, and I get quite terrified thinking what I done wrong like past life.
Well, and
that's basically, I think in China, the Buddhists always talk about. Then I don't know what my past life
was. Well, neither do I. So it's like people often ask these kind of questions, but and even though in the Buddhist scriptures the Buddha quite comfortably talks about past lives and future lives, and that's very frequently spoken about, I think it's more important to base our spiritual life, our spiritual practice, on our own experience. So if somebody has memories of past lives or what appear to be past lives, then they it's up to them to make sense of that or make use of it. Most people don't have any memories of past lives, or and so that it's more skillful then to say be paying attention to the choices that we make here in the present moment. And my own teachers would emphasize that a lot. They say, yeah, Ajahn Sumedho, what was I in a past life? And he would say, I don't know. He'd say, who were you in a past life, though? I don't know. And quite truly, he would say that that's not something that's within his experience. But what we can know is that we are seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. We can think, we can remember, we can imagine. We can see how our mind works. And so that it's more helpful to see the way that we make choices, we make decisions, and they have results here within our own lifetime. So from when you, what you did last week, or what you did when you were a child, you can remember, and you can see the results of the choices that you made. So karma doesn't have to be anything more mysterious than that. What you hear on YouTube is, there's a big variety of things, that you, all kinds of Dhamma talks and other things there. So if it's confusing, I would just say switch it off, because Dhamma is not to create more confusion, but to create clarity and to help the mind to be free of suffering. So if you put more attention on what your own experience is and see, okay, well, if I act based on friendliness, on generosity, on kindness, on harmlessness, then what's the result? Oh, it means I feel comfortable, people around me are comfortable, it brings a lot of peace. Okay, if I act out of selfishness or aggression or fear or greed, what's the result? It makes me more agitated, more confused. That leads in a bad direction. So you can see from your own actions, your own experience in the present lifetime, in your own life, how things work. So it's more helpful to focus just on that. You know, the Buddha gave a really interesting teaching in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length discourses. It's sutta number 60. It's called the Apanaka Sutta, the incontrovertible teaching. And he says, it may be to say that here is a person who lives a good life. They are kind, they are generous, they are moral, they're honest. So a person who lives like that, they attract good people to them. They are praised by wise people in the society. They sleep easily at night. And when they come to the end of their life, they have no regrets. So he said, maybe it's the case that there is no life after this one. Even if there is no life after this one, they've made a pleasant living place for themselves here and now. And if there is a life after this one, then they've set things in place to reappear in a pleasant destination. And then be another good person who lives immorally. They are unkind, they're cruel, they're selfish, they're greedy, they're deceitful. They will attract unskillful people. They'll attract bad people to them. They will be criticized by the wise people in society. They will sleep badly at night. And at the end of their life, they will have regrets. So even if there is no life after this one, then right here and now, they've made an unpleasant living place for themselves. And if there is a life after this one, then they've set the conditions for reappearing in an unpleasant destination. So let the wise person choose for themselves how they want to act. So to me, that's a really interesting teaching. The Buddha is saying, that maybe there is no life after this one. But even if there isn't, the important thing to do is to live in a skillful way. That's what is the best use of the life that we have. So that is a very, very helpful teaching in this way. Because also, Buddha Dhamma doesn't require us to believe in past lives or future lives. The Buddha encourages us to go by our own experience, to be guided by our own experience, as in what's called the Kalama Sutta. He said, don't just believe what people tell you. He didn't mention watching YouTube. It didn't exist in the Buddha's time, but equivalent to, don't just believe what people say or what people talk about in the village or in the family or what's passed down from your parents. Yeah, but the important thing is, even if it's the Buddha, in that Kalama Sutta, the Buddha said, yeah, even if it's a trusted spiritual teacher, like he himself. So don't believe what I say just because I say it, but rather test things out and see for yourself what is beneficial. And so that he's almost the only spiritual teacher who said, don't believe me, the Buddha, but rather test things out and see what is beneficial for yourself. So that it's not, he's not making the religion around believing the spiritual authority to be telling the truth, but rather, okay, you hear these words, try it out and see what's valuable, what's useful for you from your own experience, and then be guided by that. Okay? Yes. Okay, Evgenia, you can go first. Yeah. Oh, there's this gentleman here with the white t-shirt, grey t-shirt. There's a switch on the side.
Switch?
Yes.
You talked about conflict generating emotions such as anger and resentment, and even people like Ajahn Sumedho, with all his wisdom, experiencing those emotions and observing them. But as if we doesn't that reflect attachment to ideas and feelings and thoughts and so on, and ultimately, if we don't have those attachments, shouldn't we not be feeling those emotions? But if somebody like Ajahn Sumedho, even with all his wisdom, was still feeling them, what hope is there for the rest of us?
Well, it's like the I mentioned karma and vipaka. So vipaka is the resultant karma. So if certain sort of wheels have been set in motion in years gone by, like the impact of that chief petty officer on his ship during the Korean War, more than 50 years ago, more like 60 years ago now, the effect of those wheels having been spun all those years ago, it's like they don't just stop. Or that, also not just with anger, but they say sadness, maybe the memory of your beloved mother having passed away, something like that. So that the emotions might arise, but the issue is how the mind relates to that. So there can be a feeling of disliking or a feeling of liking, like a bitter taste or a sweet taste, but it's what the mind does with that. So that you get different renditions of this in different Buddhist teachings, but so out of the Thai forest tradition, it's very much the way they talk about these kind of negative emotions or afflictive emotions is that, yeah, even in an arahant, they will arise, but there's no landing place for them. Like one of the great forest Ajahns, Lumpo Dun, when he was in his 90s, one of his disciples asked him, very politely, "Yeah, Lumpo, I hate to ask this, but do you still experience anger?" He said, "Oh yes." He said, "Me dan mai ao," which is like it arrives, it's there, but I don't accept it. It's like the delivery van comes, but the parcel's not, nobody signs for the parcel. So the delivery person takes the parcel away again. It's like they're not accepting it, they're not receiving it. That emotion might take shape, but there's no imputing reality or solidity or value to it. So in the scriptures, you get a lot of dialogues between the Buddha and Mara, the subject of next week's Dhamma talk. So in these dialogues between the Buddha and Mara, it's depicted in the form of Mara as this kind of entity, this sort of demonic, sort of like a music hall villain, almost like, ha, 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 I'll get him this time. You know? This kind of almost like a joke-like figure coming along to try and trick the Buddha. And it's portrayed in the scriptures in those ways. And the Buddha always says, you know, I know you, Mara. Yeah. I know you, evil one. And Mara sort of has to scurry away, and it never manages to trick the Buddha. But I feel what that's representing is those feelings of worry or greed or self-criticism arising in the mind of the Buddha, but they'd have no place to land. So like there's an incident where he's sitting in the Himalayas, and Mara comes to him and says, you know, you've got the kind of power. You could turn the entire Himalayan mountain range into solid gold. You could do that. Go on. And then the Buddha says, I know you, Mara. Yeah, it's true, I could turn the whole Himalayan mountain range into solid gold, but twice that amount would not be enough for one person's greed. So, curses, foiled again. So Mara goes scurrying off. And so that's depicted in this kind of exchange between the Buddha and Mara as two sort of living beings talking with each other. But I feel it's also a representation of that thought arising in the Buddha's mind. You know, I could turn all these mountains into solid gold. But then immediately there's the recognition that even as that thought takes shape, yeah, that what would be the point of that? Because that wouldn't be twice that amount would not be enough for one person's greed. Or the Buddha lying down to take a rest in the middle of the day during the hot season, and Mara comes along and says, you're supposed to be a fully enlightened Buddha. What are you doing lying down in the middle of the day? Lazy. Lazy monk. Yeah. What kind of a spiritual teacher are you? And then the Buddha says, you know, I know you, Mara. And says, you know, it's the hot season, and there's nothing unskillful whatsoever in the heat of the day to lie down mindfully on my right side, to set in mind the time for awakening, to let the mind go to sleep, and then to let it wake up again. There's nothing unskillful there at all. Yeah, I know you, Mara. So, and there's many incidents like that, and I feel what it's doing is representing those self-critical or greedy, fearful habits that arise in the mind. But there's, like Lungpo Dun saying, there's no one receiving it. There's no place for it to land. There's no validity given to it. But those forms will arise. And so I realize that's debatable, and other people might disagree. But I feel that's a very realistic way of viewing those kind of dialogues. And so that. I would say don't be afraid of those feelings of aversion or jealousy arising, because the more mindfulness and wisdom there is, then the sooner they're caught. And there's no strength given to them. If you've signed for the parcel and you've already opened it and said, actually, do I really want to open this? So well, you actually signed for it, so it's yours now. So when we're less than enlightened, then that's what happens. We pick things up and we follow those. But I would say that the more that we the heart is really freed from greed, hatred, and delusion, then those different feelings of fear or desire or aversion, judgment can arise. But the mind is totally capable of not making anything out of it. So it's not suppressing the emotion or turning yourself kind of numb. But rather, it's a recognizing it for what it is. So, like with one of the reasons why Ajahn Chah was such a highly admired teacher was because he would accept people like that, the loud mouthed monk, and that he could accept eccentricity, he could accept difficulty, and that and he was quite. He didn't generate it on purpose, apart from running a very, very strict routine. But he would be constantly encouraging people to use that the friction that came from living with difficult people or say being ready to accommodate things that were difficult or challenging, because that's how you develop more wisdom. It's often quoted how when Ajahn Sumedho in 1981 he went back to visit Ajahn Chah in Thailand, and Chidhurst Monastery had been open for a couple of years, and it was the first time they'd seen each other since Ajahn Chah had left England in 1979. So Ajahn Sumedho got back to Wat Bopong, and Lumpur said, so how's it going, Sumedho? And he said, oh, Lumpur, it's amazing. Yeah, Chidhurst is going really well. I've never lived with such an inspiring group of monks. They're really dedicated, they're committed, they're very diligent, they're very self-disciplined, self-motivated. And you know, the nuns community, there's four of them living down in this little cottage, and they work really hard at their practice, and they're an inspiring group of women. I've never lived with such a really uplifting and kind of magnificent group of practitioners. Waxing lyrically like this, thinking that Lumpur was going to say, oh, well done, Sumedho, I feel very happy for you. But instead, Lumpur was completely unimpressed. He said, well, you won't develop very much wisdom living with that lot. You know, it is completely indifferent to all of the kind of positive side of it. He said, I don't think he said, I'll send you a few difficult monks to spice things up. The difficulties came along anyway. But if we push conflict and difficulty away, if we try to suppress it, then we just avoid conflict or avoid difficulty, avoid emotions, then we can get quite good at suppressing. But then we also make things stronger. We create by pushing something away, you empower it. There's a little passage from the one thing that Ajahn Chah's teacher, Venerable Ajahn Mun, wrote, called The Ballad of Liberation from the Five Khandhas. It says, wanting what's good without stop, that's the cause of suffering. It's a great fault, the strong fear of bad. Good and bad are poisons to the mind, like foods that inflame a high fever. The Dhamma isn't clear because of our basic desire for good. Desire for good, when it's great, drags the mind into turbulent thought until the mind gets inflated with evil and all its defilements proliferate. The greater the error, the more they flourish, taking one further and further away from the genuine Dhamma. So that sense of fear of difficulty or fear of that challenge, you empower it by pushing it away. And that Ajahn Chah's style was to, in a sense, be open to difficulty, open to difficult people, difficult situations, difficult feelings, illness, and so forth, and to be consciously using that that friction as a way of waking up. In Greek mythology, the cause of the Trojan War was because there was this wedding in Mount Olympus, They wanted the wedding to go really smoothly, and so I think it was Cadmus and Harmonia were getting married. Harmony was one of the people, was the bride getting married, and so they thought, well, it's Harmonia's marriage. We don't want anything to go wrong, so we'll make sure that Eris, the goddess of discord, is not invited. Don't invite Eris because she only causes trouble, the goddess of discord. So of course Eris found out about the wedding, and thought, didn't invite me. So being the goddess of discord, then she famously created this golden apple, and on the apple she wrote the words, for the most beautiful, and then rolled it into the wedding feast. So, oh, look, what's this beautiful apple? Oh, for the most beautiful. So who's the most beautiful? So then that caused the beauty contest between Hera, Aphrodite, and Athena. And there was differences of opinion about who should win the contest, and then that led to the none of the gods would be the judge. They all scooted off, and then Paris was chosen as the person to judge the contest. He chose Aphrodite, and then the other two, Hera and Athene, were upset with the choice, and then that led to the whole Trojan War. So. That's a mythological story, But and interpret it in your own various ways. If you think that beauty contests are politically incorrect, I apologize for that. But it's a Greek myth, you know, it's from 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. So. But the point being that trying to push discord away created a whole 10-year-long war when thousands and thousands of people died, and it was the cause of great conflict. So it's a myth with a message that says, don't push the discord or conflict away, don't just shut that out or try to just suppress it, because it'll only amplify it only makes it stronger. So I feel it's that kind of message embodied in Ajahn Chah's style, and Lumpo Samedo very similarly followed his dear teacher very closely, that had that much more of an inclusive openness quality, open quality to difficulty, to difficult emotions, to difficult situations, difficult people, and that their readiness to acknowledge conflict and difficulty, then that helps to, say, access the resources that can really bring it to an end. If you push it away and say, I don't want any difficulty, I don't want any kind of challenges, I want to have a nice, harmonious, tidy, completely secure environment, and anything that's difficult or problematic, you know, is exiled, you're creating a kind of numbness in yourself, and also that very act of pushing away empowers, like Ajahn Mun was saying, you're wanting what's good without stop is like foods that inflame a high fever. It creates more difficulty, creates more tension in the system. So that I feel is we're not asking for trouble, we're not looking for conflict, we're not looking for difficulty, but if there is wisdom, then when it arises, then we're taking the friction of that to be something that helps us to awaken. So Ajahn Chah would often liken it to the way you sharpen a knife on a grindstone, that you need friction to get the edge of your blade really keen, really sharp. So if you get the angle right, you get the pressure right, then you can get a really good edge on your knife. So that's the skillful use of friction is, in a way, that the way that we use dukkha, suffering and conflict, difficulty, as a way to wake up, rather than I don't want any dukkha, any difficulty, any problems in my life. Like Ajahn Chah kind of grunting to Lumpo Samedo, you won't need to develop any wisdom with that lot. So it's like don't shy away from the conflicts and difficulties that we have, but rather, as we are seeking for ways to bring them to conclusion or to resolve them, use the difficulty, the painfulness or the friction that comes from it as a way of waking up. And maybe one more. Yes, there's. We need to mark that switch a bit better.
Is that?
Yes.
Yeah, sorry. Thank you. You touched on something in your talk there about like a meditative mindfulness exercise that I've come across many times about either labeling thoughts or labeling emotions, and I just wondered how you can do that without it kind of detracting from one's personality. You know, you mentioned that about not becoming like a data-like, characterless person. And I must admit, over the years with Buddhism, that's one thing that I have struggled with, that I think, obviously, this idea of who you are as a self or a person or personality or one's character, as soon as you start speaking personally, as soon as I feel like I start to label thoughts, separate emotions from this concept of who I am, then I feel like I'm always running the risk of becoming less of who I am, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I've seen personally, first-hand experience, long-term meditators not necessarily those in the monastic community, but not wishing to name any names, but I've seen people who have managed that very well and have Ajahn Sumedho being one, obviously, who managed to keep his character and a great sense of who he was, and he maintained a as you do, great sense of self. So how do you manage that? How do you manage to detach thoughts and emotions from the concept of who you are without becoming very data-like?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the it's like learning how to ride a bicycle. You know, you can't really define exactly how you learn how to find that balance, but by doing it and doing it and doing it, you fall over to the left, fall over to the right, get your feet tangled in the chain, and then suddenly you find yourself, oh my goodness, I just rode for 10 yards and didn't fall off. How did I do that? So I think it's my experience of it is that, yeah, we can be too mechanical about it, and we get sort of overzealous in sort of naming everything, and then we make it make it far too clunky, and there's a suppressiveness. And so then, to recognize that, oh, I'm making this very, false and mechanical. So then sort of loosening the attention and lightening the grip. So it, rather like riding a bicycle, you sort of adjust this, adjust that, and then slowly you get a feel for it. So that then as you are engaging with the world, or you're watching your mind in meditation or talking to somebody, then you find a way of, oh, I'm getting really, you know, this is really exciting, or I'm enjoying this, or this is really challenging. And that way being able to be aware of what's going on, the feeling is still there, but the heart is not entangled in it in the same way. So I like to use this phrase, unentangled participating. When we talk about being the watcher or the observer or the one who knows, sometimes it gives too much of a sense of this sort of abstracted, disconnected observer, like sort of the video camera that has no consciousness but just sort of recording the data of your life. But so that language is used quite regularly in many Dhamma talks, like the silent witness, the watcher, the observer, being that. And I feel when that's sort of grasped, or that's taken too literally or seriously, you can create this false sense of disconnection. But then that in you which realizes this is always feeling a bit clunky, or this is a bit dead, or like this is really, I'm tripping over my own feet here. That's the thing that's recognizing that is the thing to trust. You see what I mean? The thing that's recognizing this is clunky, rather than I'm doing my practice really well. This is the mind noting I'm doing my practice really well, you know. That so that the term unentangled participating is trying to embody a quality of engagement, so that the heart is attuned to the sense world and to feeling and perception and interaction, but without entanglement, without being tied up with that, without being identified with it, and so that there is the unentangled quality. There's no limitation or restriction on account of that, but there's a participating. There's not a I am the observer. You know, this is data being received, and that because I feel that's a false abstraction, and that when people are relating to their meditation in that way, it can often come across like, I was told to just watch, so therefore I shouldn't. The body should be completely frozen in meditation, just not move a millimeter, because I'm just watching. But you can also just watch your ability to move your body. That your capacity to act is also part of the way things are. Do you see what I mean? And so that. That's why I like the word participation, because it's not making a false separation. And I feel that's very much what the Buddha's speaking of in terms of the middle way, that with his enlightenment, he didn't just become kind of spaced out or disconnected to the world. Yeah, it actually, it was the, like this Buddha image is the Buddha's touching the earth. That's the moment of enlightenment, when it was when he reached out and touched the earth and invoked the earth to be his witness at the moment of enlightenment. And so that it's, if that quality of enlightenment is just an inner experience of, you know, watching what's happening, and it's not connected to the body and the living world, and then it's incomplete. And so that I feel that the Buddha's response to his enlightenment was to teach and to engage mindfully with the world. He was available to connect with people and to offer his understanding to others. So that after the enlightenment, they say every word that he spoke was appropriate to the time, the place, the situation, was perfectly honest and suitable for the people he was with through the whole of the rest of his life. So there was an intense attunement to the living world, to living beings, and to people and things. The mindful use of food and clothing and shelter and so forth. So that the Buddha's detachment manifested itself in a total attunement to the way things are. So that's why I think the word participation represents that. You know, the Buddha was, kind of quote, just watching, but what he's also, he's watching his own engagement with the living world, with his own body, with the society, with the needs of the people around him. And so that getting a feel for that middle way, that's why like riding a bicycle or learning how to swim, it's like you can't ride a bike by reading a book about it. Actually, you've got to get on the bicycle and it's a whole body learning. So in a sense, what you're asking is like, is that it's a whole body learning. It's a whole being learning. And that middle way, it's a quality of balance of, oh yeah, there's a feeling of anger, and I know there's anger. There's not an identification with it, but here it is. It's a hot feeling. And it doesn't have to be suppressed. It doesn't have to be followed, but here it is. It feels like this. Just as feeling the heat of the sun on your skin or the wetness of the rain. Oh, it feels like this. So it's if you like, a living quality of balance. It's that attunement of the heart. And then recognizing where things are off, like too loose, too tight, too far to the left, too far to the right. Oh, okay, hey, I'm doing it. I'm riding the bike. Hey, look at that. And you fall off again. So that the more we practice, the more we learn how to find that middle, and then being mindful in a conversation or in a social situation or watching your mind in meditation, then you recognize that, oh, it's too slack, too tight, too far this way, too far that way, and you get to know that middle. Just like when you're riding a bicycle, you don't think, how am I balancing? You do it by doing it. It's not a concept. It's not a verbal thing. It's an attunement of the whole being. So I hope that's useful. So I think that's enough for today. So thank you for your good attention, your good questions, and do come back again next week. The title next week is "Who Do You Think Mara Is?" Something like that. So come along if you want to find out my perspective on that. Go well.